be joining us from Beirut. And also thanks to Saeed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, joining us from the British capital, London. Also, a special thanks to you, our viewers, for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul in تخفوا ما في صدوركم أو تبدوه يعلمه الله ويعلم ما في السماوات وما في الأرض والله على كل شيء قدير يوم تجد كل نفس ما عملت من خير محضرا وما عملت من سوء تود لو أن بينها وبينه أمدا بعيدا ويحذركم الله نفسه والله رؤوف رحيم
of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time. And Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines. The reports say Afghan government forces and Taliban militants are engaged in heavy fighting in parts of Kunduz, a major provincial capital. The Hezbollah chief warns Israel against further attacks on Lebanon, saying the resistance group will give an appropriate response to any aggression. And Iran questions the U.S. commitment to nuclear disarmament and criticizes Washington for modernizing its nuclear arsenals. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour, the Taliban say they've captured the third Afghan provincial capital in 2 days. The militant group has overrun the northeastern city of Kunduz, the capital of a province with the same name. That followed heavy fighting with government forces in the city center, which made them retreat to the airport. The Taliban had already taken two other provincial capitals, Zaranj in Nimruz and Shebaran in Jawzjan. But Kunduz is the most significant to fall into their hands. The group has also seized dozens of districts and border crossings in recent weeks and now are battling for several key cities. The Taliban have intensified their offensive following the withdrawal of U.S.-led foreign forces.
Footage are widely shared on Afghanistan's social media networks showing Taliban militants inside the office of Nimruz governor in Zaranj, the capital of this border province in southwest of Afghanistan.
While some representatives of Nimruz Provincial Council accuse Afghan troops of evacuating the city without resisting against the militants, a statement released by Afghanistan's Defense Ministry says 15 Taliban militants were killed in an airstrike conducted by Afghan Air Force in Zaranj City.
The 2015 Afghan National Army Corps is responsible for security in both Zaranj and Lashkargah, the capital of volatile Helmand province, where is currently the scene of heavy fighting between Taliban and Afghan troops backed by U.S. Air Force. However, top military commanders say the Afghan forces will soon push back the Taliban.
Taliban attacks have increased in some parts of Lashkargah over the past 2 weeks. Unfortunately, the Taliban have added to the misery of locals by using them as human shields. However, Afghan security forces have inflicted heavy casualties on them. We will defeat the Taliban not only in Lashkargah, but across other regions as well.
In recent Taliban advances, over 1,000 civilians were killed and tens of thousands of others were forced to flee their houses. This has doubled concerns among Afghans, saying the Taliban needs to urgently return to the negotiation table and agree with a long-lasting ceasefire.
The rising violence is taking the lives of civilians and forces them to leave their houses. Our people are peace-thirsty, and we call on Taliban to pay heed to our main demand, that is the silence of guns. Nor the government, neither the Taliban, will win through military option.
The Taliban attack on Nimruz highlights the group's agenda to control border points between Afghanistan and neighboring countries of Iran and Pakistan. Heavy fighting has also been going on in several provincial capitals. However, the government has pledged to defend the strategic centers after losing many rural districts to the Taliban in recent months. Syed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Hezbollah chief Syed Hassan Nasrallah has pledged an appropriate response to any Israeli attack. The secretary general of the Lebanese resistance movement noted that Hezbollah needed to quickly respond to the Israeli attack of Lebanese lands on August the 5th in order to maintain the deterrence power. Mayam Salah has more in this report.
The Secretary General of Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, said that the recent Israeli attack was a very dangerous development, which has not occurred in the last 15 years, stressing that the resistance needed to respond swiftly.
Our response was linked directly to the two incidents of Israeli Air Force attacks, which targeted Lebanese territory for the first time in 15 years. And our response had very clear tools and objectives. We calculated our moves very precisely. Our enemy and our friends said this. They said open territory. They did not target civilians. So we also targeted open areas with no civilians. But we had many options. We could hit open areas in Sheba Farms, in northern occupied Palestine, or the occupied Golan Heights.
Said Hassan Nasrallah made the remarks in a televised speech to commemorate the 15th anniversary of the 2006 war. He said that Israel deliberately targeted open areas in the middle of the night in order to terrorize civilians, and presumed that the resistance would not respond because of the various domestic problems inside Lebanon. Said Nasrallah stressed that the main deterrence for Israel is the capabilities of the resistance.
The enemy today is more fearful than any time in the past because of the developments in Palestine and the region and the transformations in the region and the ascending strength of the resistance and because of the deep internal divisions and the mutual hatred between the occupying Zionist groups. Facing their internal issues and the strengthening of the resistance, everyone in the Zionist entity is talking about an existential threat.
Experts believe the military potential of Hezbollah has created a balance of deterrence where Israel is incapable of even starting a war.
Israel wants Hezbollah to start the war. That situation will be different. Hezbollah is aware of this, will not Israel let him go to war, you know, anytime Israel wanted.
The leader of Lebanon's resistance noted that in any future confrontation, the Israeli military will disintegrate completely and would be heavily defeated. The 2006 war had settled a certain status quo, which remains until today, with a new regional equation, which comprises all the resistance groups in the region. Any miscalculation by the Israelis could be detrimental for Israel. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Iran slams a U.S. nuclear attack on the Japanese city of Hiroshima on the 76th anniversary of the bombardment, saying the event is a reminder of Washington's great crime against humanity. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh said the tragedy shows that the United States spares no effort to reach its illegal objectives. He described nuclear weapons as a constant threat to global peace. Khatibzadeh questioned the U.S. commitment to the Non-Proliferation Treaty and nuclear disarmament. He said Washington has not only failed to take any practical step in this regard, but has also been increasingly modernizing its nuclear arsenal. Around 140,000 people died when the United States dropped a nuclear bomb on Hiroshima on August the 6th, 1945, before dropping a second bomb on Nagasaki 3 days later. Political commentator Jason Inouye says the U.S. is the most irresponsible holder of nuclear weapons, as it's the only country that actually used them against civilians and continues to operate and upgrade them.
I don't recall the United States ever making even a single step towards the denuclearization of the country. While they've talked many years, even some past U.S. presidents have said about the inhuman nature of nuclear weapons and that it would be better if there was a world in which nuclear weapons didn't exist, which I agree, it would be a better world, but it's not something that the United States has ever worked towards. In fact, the United States has been the most irresponsible country in the world when it comes to the use of nuclear arms, as they are the only ones that have used it against a civilian population. Now, they're also primarily responsible for the sale of nuclear weapons, or probably the procurement of nuclear weapons by South Africa, who then gave them to Israel, who continue to, in a very underhanded way, threaten other countries inside the Middle East who do not wish to accept the genocide of the Palestinians or the fulfillment of the interests of the U.S. and Israel in general. These weapons still continue to proliferate. And they still continue to be upgraded and renewed by the United States every time. I mean, they pushed very much for the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which sought only to prevent countries which didn't have nuclear weapons from never getting a hold of them in the future, particularly with regards to the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. In other words, to stop an arms race by preventing anybody who couldn't already compete with them to some degree.
2 weeks after the suspension of parliament in Tunisia, actors in the country's political scene are awaiting the next step by President Kais Saied, who has activated Article 80 of the Tunisian Constitution. The article allows Saied to assume executive powers in times of national crisis. Here's more by our correspondent in Tunisia.
Tunisia has been witnessing a wave of dismissals of officials in government and judicial positions over the past days, which ended the tenure of more than 30 officials until Friday's evening. President Kais Saied denounced the poor performance of Hisham al-Mashishi's government in the epidemiological crisis.
We thank God for the presence of antibiotics in medicines and law. We thank God for having vaccines in hospitals and in the text of the constitution to confront all kinds of viruses, especially political ones.
The country has been struggling with growing COVID infections and deaths, police brutality, and dwindling economic prospects for many months. The Tunisian General Labor Union, the largest union in Tunisia, said earlier in a statement that it had prepared a roadmap to get out of the current crisis, but people are not optimistic.
The roadmap is not clear because corruption has spread across the country. So the president must fight against it with no discrimination.
The president must wait and take his time to draw an appropriate roadmap. We have to remain patient to find a good way to get out of the current political chaos. All political parties must get involved in this project.
A number of Tunisian political parties that support the decisions of President Kais Saied met and formed for a political organization to create a national consensus. President Saied's decision to dissolve parliament have been welcomed by many sides in Tunisia, but in Nahda, as the largest party in parliament enjoys strong support in the country. In Nahda has been key part of successive coalition government since 2011.
The circle of calls demanding President Kais Saied to clarify the roadmap for the next stage expanded after he announced exceptional measures on the 25th of July, while observers point out that the president's hesitation and delay in announcing his plan would benefit his opponents. Amir Bouka, Tunis.
A huge wildfire is raging on in the U.S. state of California, leaving a trail of destruction behind as firefighters are trying to contain the flames. The blaze, dubbed the Dixie Fire, is the third largest in the history of California. It has already destroyed 447,000 acres in the town of Greenville. Most of the downtown area has been leveled. At least eight people are missing. The Dixie Fire started on July 14th. Officials say it's just 21% contained. The cause of the fire remains under investigation. Greece's battle against wildfires has continued for the fifth consecutive day as hundreds of people are forced to flee their homes. The fire, which began on Tuesday on an island east of Athens, quickly spread into several fronts, devouring thousands of hectares of pristine forest in the north. The blaze also forced the evacuation of dozens of villages. The army has been deployed to help contain the fire. Greece has also received reinforcements from several countries, while locals have also joined firefighters in battling the flames. Wildfires have erupted in many parts of Greece amid the country's worst heat wave In more than 30 years, the Greek prime minister has called it a nightmarish summer, saying the government's top priority is to protect human lives. Italian protesters have staged a rally in the capital, Rome, against the mandatory COVID-19 Green Pass.
Liberta! 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 Liberta!
The protest comes a day after the government implemented the Green Pass plan to curb the spread of the coronavirus. Under the program, people need to show they've received at least one COVID jab or have recently tested negative or recovered from the disease to access a range of services and venues. A similar protest was held outside the presidential palace in the Cypriot capital, Nicosia. Demonstrators expressed anger at the country's mandatory vaccination program and Green Pass plan. Cyprus and Italy are following in the footsteps of France, whose plan to curb the outbreak has also sparked protests.
Visiting the famous Eiffel Tower in Paris has become more complicated than before. Now, people have to show an electronic document that proves that they are vaccinated twice. If not, they need to show a negative PCR test. However, most of the visitors do not consider this procedure as a problem.
It's a good opportunity to show that you're vaccinated. For me, this is perfect. This way, we are all sure that we are vaccinated.
I'm fine with it. I mean, if it lets us do things like this, then why not? To go back to some kind of normal, being able to spend time with our family, go on vacation, it's nice.
The same procedure is used to visit public places like the Louvre Museum. Rows are longer than usual because people have to show their pass.
I'm rather in favor of the health pass. If it is to protect everyone and to prevent the virus from spreading, that's better for everybody.
The French Parliament and Senate have voted this new law, and earlier this week the Constitutional Council has approved the law text. The health pass will now be extended also to bars, restaurants and trains. But protesters continue taking the streets. They were again tens of thousands in France and at least 2,000 in Paris. Why? Jerome Rodriguez, who lost his eye in a previous protest, organized this march. He explains that the problem is not the vaccination, but the limitation of liberties.
We are here to protest against the violation and decline of liberties in France. We are not here against the vaccines. The health pass is just one extra restrictive law after another. The first restrictive law was against the yellow vests, the second one about global security, and now the third with the health pass. Macron should take care of the poor people, not only of the rich companies who earned a lot of money during this COVID crisis.
The protesters are especially targeting the French government that is using force rather than persuasion to obtain a double vaccination of a large majority of the French. The reason is medical. Today, most of the people who arrive in hospitals with severe symptoms of the COVID-19 virus are not vaccinated. Most of the people who transmit the virus are not vaccinated either. Despite ongoing protests against the mandatory health pass, the majority of the French is bowing more and more to the medical evidence. Today, vaccination is the only efficient way to hold back the coronavirus. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
The coronavirus pandemic keeps taking its toll on India as a country struggling to contain the disease. India reported well over 39,000 new cases in the last 24 hours, taking its overall tally to nearly 32 million. Deaths also rose by 491 to nearly 428,000. India began the vaccination drive in January this year. Nearly 500 million of the country's 1.3 billion population have received at least one dose of the vaccination. The spike in recent cases is largely due to the more contagious Delta variant of COVID-19 that was first detected in India itself. Well, tens of thousands of Argentines have taken to the streets of Buenos Aires to protest against poverty and unemployment in the country. Unemployment organizations and left-wing groups organized the protest that began in front of the government house. Similar protests were also held in other cities across the country. The Latin American nation has been suffering a severe economic crisis for years, deepened by the coronavirus pandemic. On Friday, the government announced a relaxation of the COVID restrictions to reactivate the country's economy ahead of the legislative elections in November. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
In the limelight.
The CIA's notorious practice of kidnapping and displacement gave birth to the post-9/11 torture program. We know nearly nothing about it, says Spencer Eckerman, writer, in an article titled CIA's Outsourced Torture is Lost to History. Stay tuned for more. Despite their redactions, the pseudonyms, and the thousands of unreleased pages, the Senate Intelligence Committee's report into post-9/11 CIA torture, that is, the executive summary available to the public, is the most robust oversight ever conducted of any part of the so-called War on Terror. The committee typically defends the agencies and activities it nominally oversees. Remarkably, the torture investigation revealed the gruesome realities inside the CIA's black sites. It demonstrated with precision and rigor how the CIA constructed a big lie called enhanced interrogation around its barbarism. But the committee's lead investigator says he could only investigate two of the three components of the torture program. The third is lost to history. The CIA called the program RDI for renditions, detentions, and interrogations. Renditions are outsourced torture. The CIA abducts someone and sends them to be abused either by their home country's security apparatus or, in the extraordinary rendition variant, by a third country's security apparatus. Detentions were the maintenance, logistics, and direct operations of the black sites where the CIA, not an allied intelligence service, imprisoned people. Interrogations were the torture the CIA inflicted. Renditions were the kernel of the program. They were the only aspect of CIA torture in operation on 9/11. The entity within the CIA Counterterrorism Center that conducted it, the renditions group, expanded after 9/11 to become the RDI group or RDG. One of the people involved in the renditions group from inception, Mike Schur, explained many years ago in an underappreciated video. After 9/11, the CIA was the only game in town. The Bush White House pushed on the CIA to accelerate their rendition program. Sure has been on a journey. Yet we know vastly more about the D and the I than we know about the R. The Senate's investigation solely concerned the CIA's detentions and interrogations. Over the 6 years of the investigation, the CIA fought aggressively to restrict even that constrained mandate. It was not going to allow Senate investigators to expand their remit, according to Daniel J. Jones, the lead investigator. Everything was a heavy lift, Jones remembers. And even if the agency somehow had allowed him to investigate renditions, Jones' experience of digging through deliberately confusing and incomplete records that the CIA provided and sometimes subsequently disappeared leads him to the conclusion that the agency's own renditions records are luckily far from extensive. The CIA's detention and interrogation records in 2002 are detailed. As the DI program went on, we saw less and less robust record-keeping, Jones recalls. One could imagine that also applied to rendition. All three components of the program were tied together, and so occasionally Jones saw glimpses, suggestions, and clues to what rendition was. But not only was rendition beyond the scope of his investigation, he already had to contend with the maddening and painstaking work of figuring out who was and was not in CIA custody, then figuring out how meaningful such distinctions were when it came both to internal classifications and the actual treatment of human beings. Officially speaking, the Senate was able to tally at least 119 people whom the CIA held in the black sites during their 2002 and 2008 existence. There is a back and forth we had with the agency on who was a CIA detainee and who wasn't. The committee to arrive at 119 is extremely conservative. Everyone who was involved in this investigation believes there was more than 119 CIA detainees, Jones explained. If the CIA doesn't know how many people were in its own custody, it's very unlikely there is any record keeping of people who were merely transients, that is, briefly in CIA custody before being whisked to a partner intelligence service, and those who weren't in their custody. Tennis and every other CIA director said the torture program was the CIA's central counterterrorism program at the time, because it was a central program and incredibly sensitive. It would be reasonable to think the CIA would maintain a robust classified record, he continued. If, in fact, the DI part was viewed as the central component of the so-called war on terror by the CIA, there is no reason to believe they would hold better records with the rendition program. Two broad facts about CIA torture makes Jones' supposition especially compelling. First, the only reason the Senate Intelligence Committee investigated at all is that two leading figures inside the program, Jose Rodriguez and Gina Haspel, destroyed videotapes of the torture of two men inside the first post-9/11 black site, something that also sparked a criminal investigation. Once the Senate learned about the destruction of those tapes from the New York Times rather than from the CIA, the committee could no longer credibly refuse to open an investigation of its own. Second, in most major speeches and testimony, CIA directors George Tenet, Porter Gross, and Michael Hayden repeatedly emphasized that their so-called war on terror is an international team sport. They did this so often that journalists rarely bothered quoting it. It seemed like boilerplate. It was often self-serving, as when they cited the importance of cooperation with Allied intelligence services as a reason to never disclose what that cooperation did. But they are correct that reliance on various mukhabarats makes their war viable. I cannot overstate how vital these relationships are to our overall effort, Hayden said in one typical September 2007 appearance. The absence of renditions records, even to the Senate torture report, is no longer exactly news.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
protests in Cuba have rocked international headlines for several weeks now. It's said that they began on July 11, 2021, and have spread all across the Caribbean island into several dozens of cities. Now, the United States has not only welcomed these protests, but encouraged them too. U.S. President Joe Biden not only kept former President Donald Trump's maximum pressure campaign on the Caribbean nation, but increased sanctions, saying that this is just the beginning. Several prominent lawmakers in Congress, specifically in the Republican Party, have advocated direct intervention in Cuba, even suggesting airstrikes. Now, Cuba has responded that the entire affair is orchestrated by the United States in order to interfere in Cuba's internal politics. And they point to decades of covert and overt assaults on Cuba. They point to the embargo, and they point to the United States' efforts to malign the Caribbean nation. Several other presidents in the region expressed their support. President Maduro of Venezuela, President Obrador of Mexico, both raised concern that the United States should not be using humanitarian endeavors as a shield or a pretext in order to interfere in Cuba's internal affairs. So what is happening in Cuba? In order to find out, I went to get the other side of the story that you don't hear in corporate and mainstream media. I sat down with the chargé d'affaires of the Cuban embassy and permanent mission to the United Nations in Vienna. We talked extensively about these protests, the embargo, and much more. I'm Richard Medhurst.
And this is The Communique.
Marlene Rodendo, the chargé d'affaires here at the Cuban embassy in Vienna. Thanks for taking the time to receive us. I want to talk about what's happening in Cuba. You know, there are a lot of questions that people have. What is happening in Cuba? What are these protests that are taking place there? What's the real size of these protests? Could you tell us more about what the situation actually is there?
First of all, I would like to thank you for inviting me to your program to do this interview, because I think this is very important, because there has been a very huge disinformation campaign against Cuba. The projection of the media on the situation in Cuba has been very far from reality, even here in Vienna and in other medias in Europe. And to answer your first question regarding the real size of the protest and what is going on in Cuba right now, I first of all have to talk about what happened previously. The fact is that previous weeks it was developed a manipulation and communication campaign financed by the U.S., with the objective of inciting, encouraging people to go out to the streets with the objective of encouraging instability in the country. And they took the opportunity, the advantage of the real hard situation that Cuba is living right now due to the pandemic, due to the reinforcement of the blockade, with the application of more than 240 measures during the Trump administration. And they took that advantage to do their campaign. And during those weeks, they were inciting to violence. They were calling for vandalism acts. They were calling for assaulting the officials of Cuba. They were calling also for sabotage. And as a result, on July 11, vandals went out to the streets, announcing death for communists, breaking glass, throwing stones, making acts of vandalism. Of course, there is also known that a group of dissatisfied people also joined these disorders. Dissatisfied because they have been experiencing a very hard situation in Cuba in the recent month due to several causes. Due to the electro-energetic situation that was having problems during those days. Unfortunately, that problem is already solved in Cuba. But a group of accumulated problems, especially as a result of the blockade. Yeah. And unfortunately, the media have took advantage of that. And they have put a reality of Cuba that it is not. They have over dimension and intentionally exaggerated the size of the protest. And I want also to clarify that in Cuba there was not a social outbreak, as someone have been saying, including the media. In Cuba was disturbances, was disorder, and caused by the manipulation game and manipulation campaign of the U.S. government.
And when you say this manipulation campaign, could you maybe give us some more details? Because I recall there was a few years ago, the U.S. tried to create a Cuban version of Twitter, which was with this exact goal of subverting the Cuban government and causing social unrest. Is that something similar that happened now?
Well, yes, it's the same game. They have always applied the same rules, the same procedure against Cuba and other countries. They want to create a reality to show the world, a reality that is not like that. And that's the result. They have, you know better than me, that who have the media have the power. And unfortunately, Cuba is a small island and the U.S. is the most powerful country in the world. And they have all the means to manipulate the media.
Do you feel that the media, not just in the United States, but in the Western world in general, so in Europe, even in Austria, do you think that they've been reporting accurately and honestly on what's happening in Cuba?
No, unfortunately not. They have not respected the principle of impartiality that any journalist must have. Because I think they have limited themselves to replicate what other media said about Cuba, without verifying, without contrasting, without even inquiring or I don't know, questioning anything. They have just put the same news that they saw in other media. This is not good. I think, and I don't know if it is a cause of the lack of interest of some media or to the fear of going out the line that has been dictated to them.
I saw in The Guardian, for example, they had a crowd of people protesting, but they were holding the flag of Castro's July 26th movement,
yeah,
and they
yeah,
say
yeah.
It was anti-government.
It's really funny.
And there's even the United Nations, they use a picture of a woman who's in favor of the government. So I wanted to ask about these, like, how big is, how far does this go with this image manipulation?
They have been in an imaginal level. Because they have used false images to say certain things, and after a few days that have been discovered that is a lie. They have used an image of a parade for the 1st of May of Cuba, of course saying that this was happening in Cuba as the protest.
They say this is the slogan
the protest,
that they have.
Yeah, they say that July 11th, people went out to the streets, and this is the protest, and this is the first of May parade of Cuba. They have also made collage of pictures. This is of pictures of people wounded, even children, and none of them are of Cuba, none of them are Cubans.
You see this typical hashtag, this SOS Cuba, right?
Yeah.
They keep using this
SOS
position.
Cuba, SOS Cuba Libre, Cuba Free, it's, well.
What you're seeing happening right now in Cuba with this image manipulation, with the narratives in the media, do you feel that this is something that we've seen maybe before in Venezuela, in Syria, you know, countries that the United States doesn't like, let's put it that way.
Yeah. I think they have applied the same manual for various countries from the Middle East, from Europe, and also from Latin America. Of course, they want to do interventionist campaign in order to achieve what they call regime change. And the pattern of lies, if used, to justify a military intervention or for encouraging chaos and disturbances and instability in a country that would lead eventually to a regime change. And that's what they have done in other countries.
You know, when it comes to what they're saying, pushing for regime change, we hear some of the loudest voices in favor of regime change. There are Cubans or Cuban exiles living in Miami. Miami is a very big hotspot for this, and these calls for regime change, increasing sanctions, bombing Cuba, do these opinions represent the majority of Cubans living in Cuba?
No. No. This is not the image of the Cubans abroad, and I thank you very much for this question, because this is very important. I have the opportunity to clarify the people who see this interview. Well, it is true that some radical groups in Miami, especially in Miami, are asking for military interventions and calling for concrete actions against Cuba and saying messages of hate even towards their own relative in Cuba. But this is not the real image that the majority of the people abroad. I think the majority of the people abroad, the Cuban people abroad, love their homeland. love their country. Because I'm not speaking about the ideology. I'm speaking about love to your land, love to your people. And that's what I feel. And this is very important to clarify, because the media have played a very important role here. The media have tried to highlight the manifestation of hate of the Cuban people. But you can also find on internet images, videos, and messages of, for the other side, for the vast majority of the Cuban people, saying messages of love, strength, and solidarity. And I want to also to recognize, and this is very important, because meanwhile, a part of these radicals were making demonstrations in front of our headquarters, of the Cuban headquarters abroad, diplomatic headquarters, and saying offenses and doing vandalism acts against, yeah, against our embassy.
I saw in Paris yesterday.
Yeah. A vast majority of the other Cubans were struggling to gather medical supplies to send to Cuba. Yeah, they were doing a lot of efforts trying to send shipments to Cuba with medical supplies, and they achieved that. We have received in Cuba hundreds of shipments of medical supplies thanks to the efforts of these Cubans, of the vast majority of Cubans, with messages of love, strength, solidarity, and unity. And I think that's the image of the Cuban abroad.
When you hear not just Cubans, expatriates or exiles, but politicians, Cuban Americans, like we have Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz, you know, they're calling for action, whatever that means. And you had the Miami mayor, actually, Suarez, who was saying that airstrikes should be on the table. I mean, what is your reaction when you hear things like that, that someone, another person, never mind someone who is claiming to be Cuban, is calling to bomb Cuba? What is your reaction to that?
Well, that is difficult. Because I believe that these people you mentioned, this U.S. politician, doesn't feel like Cubans. That's the answer to your question. Because any Cuban who loves its country cannot promote or call for airstrikes against your own land. And those politicians, I believe that they have a very strict line of political interest, economic interest, and also electoral interest. So they call for maintaining the distance between the U.S. and Cuba. They are also against the rebuilding of ties. I think those people are not Cubans. They don't feel like Cuban.
What's more interesting, considering these politicians in the United States, you know, some of them call themselves socialists or progressives, and yet, you know, when they talk about Cuba, they as we say, I think it's called both-siding the issue. So they say, on one hand, yes, the embargo should be lifted on Cuba. And then they also say that the government is anti-democratic. It's brutalizing the Cuban people. So they repeat the same kind of rhetoric, the same line as, you know, the people we were just talking about now previously. I mean, what are your thoughts on that, like, you know, these politicians?
I believe that those politicians in the U.S. receive a lot of pressure from others. Any politician who wants to express an opinion different from that is the vision of the government receive critics, and it's not well seen in the U.S. And saying something good about Cuba and in the U.S. it has a very high cost for a U.S. politician. That's why I couldn't somehow understand why those politicians have to, on one hand, to criticize the blockade, and on the other hand, to criticize Cuba to make a balance. But however, I want to recognize and also express my appreciation to those politicians that, in spite of the differences in ideology, have been brave enough as to reject and criticize the policy of sanction against Cuba. That's not an easy action in the U.S., and they have done that.
Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Considering the ties between the United States and Cuba, Joe Biden, when he was running for president during his campaign, he promised, he said that he would go back to the era of Obama in terms of relations with Cuba. So far, he's failed to do so. Why do you think that is?
Joe Biden has not only maintained the blockade, he has also maintained the reinforcements of the blockade with the 243 measures applied by the Trump administration, and also the 55 measures applied during the time of the pandemic. And he has even applied other sanctions last week against one official of my country and also an entity of my country. And he said that this is just a beginning. So, speaking about the reason, this is just hypothetical because I have not all the answers. But in my opinion, I believe that this behavior of Biden is a result of the very strong pressures he has been receiving from representatives of these radical groups of anti-Cubans that have been asking for concrete actions against Cuba and military intervention. And also he has maybe this behavior is due to the the electoral ambitions that Joe Biden has. Towards the Florida state.
As you have recalled, he said that this is just the beginning, which, I mean, it sounds like a threat. It's a veiled threat. I mean, do you think that there's any hope the United States will move towards reestablishing ties with Cuba or improving ties in this term, at least?
Well, I hope so. I hope so. We have time. The beginning has not been so good. Actually, has been very bad, even worse than Trump administration, because he maintained the same sanctions that Trump's and even put another one. But we have to give the benefits of the doubt to Biden. Maybe in a few months the policy change. But right now I have not hope. I have no hope because the situation has been very bad.
Speaking of the situation, Cuba is the only country in Central and Latin America who's actually been able to develop its own COVID-19 vaccine. However, as we've seen because of the embargo, there have been ventilator shortages, syringe shortages. There's all kinds of medical equipment that Cuba's unable to access from abroad. How much has this embargo worsened the situation, even though Cuba has made huge leaps and even sent doctors to other countries to fight this?
I have to start saying that not a single family in Cuba has not been affected by the blockade. Everyone has been affected because the blockade affects every dimension of the Cuban economy and society. And you have mentioned in your question the problems, the difficulties that Cuba has in getting supplies, medical supplies during the pandemic, and this has been as a result of the blockade. And I think that the most painful dimension of the blockade is the impact on the health situation, on the health system in Cuba. And another example of the health system, of the impact of these sanctions, is that we in Cuba are deprived from acquiring some medicines only produced in the U.S. For the treatment of cancer, for example. Yes. And this is very painful for the Cuban people, and this is very alarming also.
If we're clear that the embargo and the various other measures that the United States and its allies have taken against Cuba, they do affect the situation economically, socially. I mean, how do you respond to people who try to frame the entire situation, like all these problems, as just the government's fault? You know, they say, oh, this is socialism, and it's the government's fault. And as you mentioned, they say the embargo has nothing to do with this. I mean, what would you respond to these people?
Well, first of all, I have also to recognize that the government of Cuba is not perfect. We have the government has its defects, its deficiencies. Any other government of the world has, and we have tried to resolve those problems. Even the president of the Republic of Cuba have expressed it in several times that we have deficiencies and we have to solve it. And we are in the middle of the process of updating our system, our economic and social system, especially in order to that, in order to try to solve our problems. But I can assure you that the biggest obstacle that the development of our economy has is the blockade, is the effect of the blockade. And also, if the solution to our problems depending on the internal decision, I believe that long time ago the people of Cuba would be living in much better conditions than they do right now. And unfortunately, the solution does not depend on the willingness of the government of Cuba, but on the willingness of the government of the U.S.
We see that Cuba sends doctors to a lot of countries. The United States sends soldiers to other countries, as we were just talking about. They occupy other countries around the world. Where does this difference in ideology come from? Why is it that Cuba is sending missions of doctors to help other countries, and the United States sends Marines? I mean, where does this come from?
Our national hero, José Martí, you must have known about it. He used to say a phrase, a very known phrase in Cuba. He said that men, the human, divided into two kinds, those who love and found, and those who hate and destroy. And I think that the main difference between U.S. government and Cuba is principles. The Cuban Revolution is based on the principle of solidarity, while the government of the U.S. With neoliberal imperialism moves by interest, economic, political, and geostrategic interest, and it has no limits. It has been proved with the dropping of the nuclear bombs to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and also in the multiple wars and conflicts that they have been created and financed, and which they have took benefits from.
What is the worst lie you've seen? And I know this is a big question because there's a lot, but what is the biggest piece of misinformation or mistruth or blatant lie that you've heard about Cuba, whether it's in the media or on social media?
I would like to refer to the two biggest lies I have seen. The first one is of the missed people, the disappears, yeah. They have even circulated a list of hundreds of disappears in Cuba, and it has been proved by the government that those people are not disappeared. They even included an official, people who work in the cinema production in Cuba, and this person, when he saw his name, he said, "Well, I'm disappeared." This is unbelievable, and this is completely out of order. This is not real. In Cuba, there is not a single people missed. And the other thing was they were saying, especially in the social media, that in Cuba the government took in prison children. Yeah, this is completely also false. We have a priority to take care of children. We don't take children in prison and during the protest. This is completely wrong. And yes, there are a lot of other lies, but this is the two shocking one. Yeah.
Marlene Rodendo, thank you so much for your time. And I'm very grateful for your time for receiving us here. Thank you so much. It's really my pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you. It has been a huge pleasure. And thank you so much for trying to get the truth about Cuba. This is not common, and I have to congratulate you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The Limelight.
The dehumanization of Palestinians and those in support of the Palestinian cause is so pervasive and necessary to keeping the U.S. support for Israeli regime intact that this shockingly discriminatory treatment is not even acknowledged as racism within the mainstream, says Omar Zahza, journalist, in an article titled "Fired for a Facebook Post, Doctor Seeks Justice." Stay tuned for the details of this article, please.
As bombs rained down on the besieged Gaza Strip in May, countless individuals took to social media to express their outrage over the latest slew of atrocities perpetrated by the Israeli regime military. The cruelty of these strikes seemed to be surpassed only by the indiscriminate nature of infrastructure targeted. Residential buildings, the only COVID-19 testing center, and associated press office. Online outrage at what was happening was widespread. But in some cases, that outrage had material repercussions. On May 26, Dr. Fida Wisha, an accomplished Palestinian-American pedestrian from Gaza now living in Phoenix, Arizona, took to her personal Facebook page to express her outrage at the injustice playing out in real time. This was far more than an abstract ethical issue for Wisha, as she explained over the phone. The last attack on Gaza was painful for me because I still have family there. My mom, her sister, has five kids. They showed me the house that had been bombed. She was telling me hopefully we will survive the night. She was telling me that they would stay in the hallway because that was the safest place for them, she said. Bisha's Facebook account is private, but she had made all her Palestine-related